Okay. I was mentioned last week the topics we're going to try to focus on during this this upcoming season are topics related to tefillah. And I decided that it might actually take a start from the end. Sometimes if you know, I had a Rebbe in Yeshiva who once said that the best way to cover ground when you're learning is to skip. So I guess by starting at the end, you know, we can give ourselves an artificial sense of accomplishment that we made it all the way to the end. We've learned about Aleinu, one of the last things that we say during our davening. Aleinu is a tefillah which is very, very familiar, I think, to most of us. It's one that even if we don't say many tefillahs, Aleinu is one of the ones that did well, that was zocha to be said by a wide variety of people, regardless of how much they say. So I wanted to try to focus on it, to try to understand it a little bit better, to talk a little bit about its origins, and to try to understand its significance and some of the kavanas we can have while saying it. Who wrote Aleinu? So this is a question. As we may know, Aleinu finds itself in the Malchus, the bracha of that describes God's kingship, which we recite as part of the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. The whole Malchus bracha is introduced with the recitation of Aleinu. It would seem that that's the original placing of Aleinu, and the notion of saying Aleinu at the end of our tefillos on a daily basis is something that happened in a later point in history. If you look back at some of the oldest Sidurim that we have, they do not mention Aleinu as a tefillah which is recited at the end of davening. So to take one example, the Rambam in his Mishnah Torah, the Rambam lived in the 1000s, so the Rambam has a listing, a complete Siddur, in his Mishnah Torah, his volumes of Halacha, where he basically goes through the entire text of the davening, again, the Rambam's version of the entire text of the davening, and he makes no reference to the idea of saying Aleinu at the end of davening. Similarly, one of the oldest Siddurim that we have, even predating the Rambam, is a Siddur from Rav Amram Gaon, which Rav Amram Gaon was one of the Gaonim, one of the Rabbanim who was active following the closure of the Talmud. He also does not make any reference to the idea of Aleinu being something which would be recited at the end of davening on a regular basis. So it seems that the earliest part in which Aleinu was introduced into the davening was as the introduction to the bracha of Malchus. As such, we find that the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us that entire section of the davening, in other words, the setup of Malchus, the Chronos, and Shofros, the way we have it on Rosh Hashanah, was composed by the Amora Rav. Rav was the one of the preeminent Rabbanim who, as the Gemara tells us, really started Torah learning in Babylonia, in Bavel. You know, before Rav came to Bavel, there were many Jews in Bavel, but there was really very little formal Torah learning. He brought the whole idea of the yeshiva to Bavel, started the Torah scholarship in Bavel. So it seems like he composed the structure of the Malchus, the Chronos, and Shofros the way we have it. So he's credited with certainly doing something with the Tefillah of Aleinu. Nonetheless, we actually find that there are sources that indicate that the authorship of Aleinu goes back even further than Rav. There is a tshuva from Rav Haigal, again, one of the early sources right after the Talmud was completed, where Rav Haigal indicates that the text of Aleinu was actually written by Yehoshua ben Nun, right, the disciple and the heir to Moshe Rabbeinu. And he writes that Yehoshua instituted the recitation, or he wrote Aleinu and instituted it to be said when the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael at a very early time. So there's a commentary called the Iyun Tefillah. The Iyun Tefillah is part of a beautiful set of Sfarim that goes through many of the sources of the Tefillahs called the Osar HaTefillahs, and it was written by Rabbi Ariel Gordon, in the Sefer Iyun Sila, he suggests that the way we have Aleinu today may be a composite between Yehoshua ben Nun and Rav. He says there are certainly phrases in Aleinu that speak to having been written at a later period. So, for instance, we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Aleinu as HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? The whole idea of referring to God as HaKadosh Baruch Hu is something we don't really find in Tanakh. We find it a lot in Chazal. So, using that phrase would seem to indicate more of a composition in the time of Chazal than in the time of the Tanakh, but nonetheless, he suggests that maybe Yehoshua wrote it in a rough draft version, and, you know, the exact version that we have today, with some of the terminology perhaps changed a little bit here and there, was changed by Rav in the period of the Amoraim. We find that Aleinu has a tremendous amount of there's a tremendous importance and significance that's ascribed to Aleinu throughout the generations. We already mentioned this tradition that Yeshua composed Aleinu when he came into Eretz Yisrael, so obviously there's something very important going on over there. We know that at a certain point in time, Aleinu was introduced to be said at the end of davening every day. When exactly was that? So the first reference we find to Aleinu being recited at the end of our tefillos is found in a sefer called the Machzor Vitri. Right, so Machzor is a term we use today to describe the Siddur, which is only used for Yom Tovim. But way back when, hundreds of years ago, Machzor was the term which they used interchangeably with the word Siddur. So Machzor Vitri just means the Siddur from Vitri. Okay, so now we understand half of what it means. What's the other half of it? What's Vitri? So Vitri is a town in France, and the author of the Machzor Vitri was a Gadol B'Yisrael by the name of Rav Simcha of Vitri. He was a Talmud of Rashi. Right, so again, if you think about it, Rashi died in 1105. We're talking about a Siddur that dates back to the 1100s. In the Machzor Vitri, you know, Rav Simcha of Vitri already records that there was a practice to recite Aleinu at the end of every davening before they would leave shul. We also have the tradition that Aleinu was associated with martyrs, with Jews who died al Kiddush Hashem. During the 1200s, there was a massacre of Jews in a place called Blois in France, and the tradition that we have it is that many of those Jews who were massacred, you know, went to their deaths reciting Aleinu. Alright, so here also we see that obviously there's some tremendous significance associated with the tefillah if it was the last tefillah that people were saying, you know, right before they were killed. So what is it about Aleinu that is so incredibly striking and so incredibly important? Basically, if you look at the text of Aleinu, Aleinu makes the point that we are proud to be Jewish, we are proud to be worshipping Hashem, and we are proud to not be worshipping idols like the non-Jews around us are. Right? Those are really the main points, certainly, of the first paragraph of Aleinu. We are proud to be Jewish, we are proud to be worshipping Hashem, and we are proud to not be worshipping idols unlike the nations of the world around us. And let's just translate some of the phraseology which is familiar to us, and we'll see how those ideas leap out at us. It is incumbent upon us to praise the master of everything, to ascribe greatness to the one who made the entire world. Why do we have to give thanks to Hashem? He did not make us like the nations of all of the lands, and he did not place us like the families of the earth. He did not make our portion like their portion. And he did not make our goral, our lot, like all of their masses and multitudes. We are different than everyone else. Now, at this point, there is a line which exists in some Sidurim and is absent in other Sidurim. Right? In many Sidurim, following the words V'garaleinu k'chol ha'monam, we find the following line: Shehei mishpach adim lehezo vorik. They, the nations of the world, bow down to nothingness and emptiness. U'mishalalim el el lo yoshia, and they pray to a God who cannot save them. That, by the way, is actually based on a pasuk in Yeshaya. Right? That they bow down to nothingness and emptiness. They pray to a God who cannot save them. And then the line that follows is the perfect contrast to that. Va'anachnu, but as for us, we karim u'mishtachavim u'ma'odim l'fnei melech malchei hamlochim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We bow down and we prostrate ourselves and we acknowledge the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. Right? When we put in that line, Shehem Ishtachav in Lehevel Vorik, the truth is the tefillah reads a lot smoother, because just think about what the tefillah has been saying. We are not like the nations of the world. We are happy that we are different. We are happy that we are Jewish. We are happy that we were that we have a different mission in life. They bow down to idols, but we bow down to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? We also know that that line, Shehei Mishtachavim Lehev Vavarit, is absent in many Sidurim, or in some Sidurim it's there, but in parentheses. What's the story behind that? So, apparently, during the Middle Ages, that line was targeted by the censor, by the Christian censor, in many, many circumstances, and was forcibly removed from the Tefillah of Aleinu. The argument went, that line is anti-Christian. Why is that line anti-Christian? Well, there was actually an apostate, in other words, a Jew who was born Jewish, who then converted to Christianity, who pointed out that the gematria of Vorik comes out to be the same gematria as Yeshu. Right? So in other words, he argued to the church, when the Jews are talking about how they bow down to Hevel Vorik, they bow down to emptiness and nothingness, and bow to a God, and they pray to a God who cannot save them, what the Jews really, really mean is Yoshka. What they really mean is Yeshu HaNotri. So this very prayer is not only a prayer about how fortunate we are to be Jewish, it's actually a very explicit statement about how happy we are that we're not Christian. We know in general, or if we don't know, we're about to find out, the Catholic Church was very, very much on top of Sfarim that were produced during the Middle Ages, and they felt very free and very entitled to censor numerous passages in the Siddur, in the Gemara, in copies of the Rambam and the like. Because the Christian church, you know, the priests at that time, many of them were very learned in Hebrew. They actually could read the Sfarim very, very well. And anything that was in the Sfarim which they felt was anti-Christian, even in the slightest, to the slightest degree, was very promptly taken out or changed, you know, in the Siddur. I mean, to take one other example of that that may be familiar to us, you know, one of the brachos which we have in Shemana Esrei begins V'lam al Shinim, right? For talebearers, there should be no hope. V'lam al Shinim al Tihi Sikva. That tefillah, again, eventually we'll get to it, but that tefillah was composed by Chazal. It was composed by the Gemara tells us that a Tana by the name of Shmuel HaKatam composed that particular bracha, and it was composed to be against the various heretics and sectarian Jewish groups that were a threat to the mainstream Jewish groups during the period of the Mishnayos. Apparently during the Middle Ages it was understood by the church, perhaps rightly, perhaps wrongly, that that bracha of Olam al Shinim was a knock against Christianity. And for that reason, there are many, many versions of that bracha of Olam al Shinim. Many of them have been redone and, edited in a very, very drastic fashion by the Catholic Church, to the point where the bracha which we say today is probably very far removed from the bracha the way it was, you know, meant to be set up by Chazal. If you happen to look, if you ever look at a Sardi Siddur, you know, in the Sardi world they were not subject to the Catholic Church. They didn't deal with them. So the Sardi version of the bracha of Olam al Shinim is very, very different than the Ashkenazi version of the bracha. Again, because in the Ashkenazi world, the Catholic Church really did a major job editing that bracha, making it very, very different from the original version, which the Sardi version is probably much closer to, again, because they didn't have the editing of the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church, Kohenu v'Kohenu, you know, very, very frequently got involved in the Siddur and tried to change things wherever they thought things were anti-Christian. This line of Shehen Shachavim Lehev Ovarikum is Alulim Alelo Yoshia was one of the victims of the Catholic Church, and for many, many years it was taken out of the Siddurah. Truth be told, again, when you read the Tefillah of Aleinu, it's just thematically, it makes a lot of sense to have that line in there, because it reads, the Tefillah itself reads a lot better, reads a lot smoother with that line there. We're happy we're not like the nations of the world. They bow down to idols, but we bow down, you know, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Is it a reference to Christianity? It's a pasuk in Yeshaya. I mean, again, Yeshaya was a Navi, you know, so he certainly saw things in the future. But, you know, it's hard on the surface to say that it's a reference to Christianity when the original context of those lines, Shehem Yishtachavim Lehev Ovarik, Mispalu and Alelo Yoshia, are in the Tanakh itself, you know, centuries before Christianity even came on the scene. So that's, you know, in some of the contemporary Sidurim, there's an attempt to put the line back in. The article quotes one of the Brisker Rabbanim, Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, Mariel Diskin, as being very, very insistent that, you know, the line should be recited. He says, you know, you can't say my minhag is not to recite it. Your minhag is wrong. Your minhag is based on the Catholic Church in the center in the Middle Ages. That's what your minhag is based on. So if he says no, you should put it back in, because that's really, you know, part of the original text of Aleinu. Be that as it may, it's clear that this initial part of Aleinu speaks about the pride in being Jewish and the difference between being Jewish and, you know, being one of the idolatrous nations of the world. They bow to their idolatry. We only bow to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In light of that, it's relatively easy to understand why this would be a tefillah which would be on the lips of martyrs in Blois, in France, in the 1200s. Because after all, why were these Jews being killed, you know, in that anti-Semitic episode? They were being killed because they refused to bow to the cross. They refused to become Christian. They said, no, we believe in a monotheistic religion. We only bow down to God. We don't bow down to his son or his cousin or anybody else, you know, who we think might be related to the Ribbono Shel Olam, as it were. We bow down to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And, you know, this expression of commitment to God was something they felt strongly enough about that this was the tefillah they wanted to say as they were going to their deaths. You know, we can understand that in light of the text of Aleinu itself. We can also understand why Aleinu, starting sometime in the 1100s, started to be recited at the end of davening each day. And here there's a very beautiful insight from the Bach, the Biolo Circus, who lived in Krakow in the 1500s. The Bach wrote a commentary on the tour. The Bach writes that the reason the custom developed to place Aleinu at the end of davening was for the following reason. The whole time that we were, you know, davening, again, certainly in the case of men, we were in shul. We were surrounded by an environment which is very conducive to the values of Torah. when we finish davening, we're about to go into the big wide world which is out there. And in the world out there, there are many influences and many forces which are against the values of Torah which we hold to be sacred. Said the Bach, we recite Aleinu at the end of davening to remind ourselves one last time before we head out into that great wide world that we're proud to be Jewish, we wouldn't want to be anything else. And even when we come into contact with so many non-Jews who are idolaters, who are following a different religion, a different value system than we have, we are still proud and happy of what we have, right? We may look around, again, thinking historically, we may look around and say, hey, you know, pretty good to not be Jewish. Here we are, we're in a ghetto. You know, we're leading lives which are very persecuted. You know, we feel like second-class citizens. And they, you know, they have money, they have prominence, they have, you know, they're high-ranking people in society. Don't we wish that we could be like them? So Aleinu comes and reminds us at the end of davening, right before you're about to go out to work, you know, you're going to work as a peddler and you're going to see all of these, you know, fancy non-Jews passing by and maybe yearn, you know, to be in their shoes. No, Shalom Asanu Kigayeh Ha'arotzov. We remind ourselves again and again, no, you know, we're happy to be us. We wouldn't want, you couldn't pay us, you know, even to adapt the stature, the status of people in the non-Jewish world. We are incredibly happy, you know, to be serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we reject the values, you know, the idolatrous values of all the people around us. As the Bach says, that's why they started out saying Aleinu at the end of davening, because that message is particularly important before you're about to rush out and go out to the big wide world out there. By the way, we should point out that there are slight differences between those who daven Nusach Ashkenaz and those who daven Nusach Sfarad as to when exactly you say Aleinu at the end of davening. Right, so those who daven Nusach Sfarad know that Aleinu was literally the last thing you say right before you finish the you know, davening Shacharis. And those who daven Nusach Ashkenaz, we have usually some stuff, a little bit of stuff after Aleinu, you know, that we finish up, you know, before we actually finish. I mean, it's most pronounced in terms of the Shir Shalyom. When you daven Shacharis, is the Shir Shalyom before Aleinu, or is it after Aleinu? If you daven Sfarad, Shir Shalyom comes first and then Aleinu. And if you daven Ashkenaz, Aleinu comes first and then the Shir Shalyom comes afterwards. The truth is, according to the Bach's explanation, it's much easier to understand the way Nusach Sfarad does it. Because according to the Bach, Aleinu is literally the last thing you're supposed to be saying right before you walk out the door. Because, you know, you're about to be exposed to the big wide world out there. You need this inoculation, if you were, that Aleinu provides. So in Nusach Sfarad, that the last thing you say is Aleinu, that makes a lot of sense. Nusach Ashkenaz is a little bit harder to understand. Unless we figure in Nusach Ashkenaz, you know, you can hold on to that feeling of Aleinu even through the Shir Shalyom. You know, Shir Shalyom usually isn't that long. So maybe, you know, Nusach Ashkenaz feels you can hold it a little bit longer till you get the outside, you know, into the outside world. But again, on the surface, it's easier to understand the ordering of Nusach Sfarad, you know, with regard to this issue. The truth is, this idea of the Bach also helps us understand, I think, the attribution of Aleinu to Yehoshua. We mentioned before this Shuvah from Rav Haigon, where Rav Haigon says that Aleinu was written by Yehoshua. So, okay, why did Yehoshua feel this need to compose this tefillah known as Aleinu? What moved him, you know, to make up such a tefillah? And I think the answer is, again, especially in light of what the Bach tells us, that Aleinu is a tefillah which helps us maintain our Jewish pride and our pride in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu even in the midst of a very non-Jewish society. When the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael under Yehoshua, it was the first time in 40 years that they really had to encounter a non-Jewish society. Right? When they were in the Midbar, when they were in the desert for the past 40 years, they were living in a bubble. I mean, it was a Jewish ghetto. It was a great Jewish ghetto. You know, there was food that fell from the skies every day. you know, the clothes didn't wear out. They had a well that was providing them with water. They were surrounded by clouds, you know, that were protecting them from all kinds of, you know, terrible things. It was a great ghetto, but it was a ghetto. You know, the Jews were, you know, sort of in a little bubble while they were in the desert for 40 years. Now they're coming to Eretz Yisrael, and for the first time, they're really dealing with non-Jewish societies. It's really the first time that they have to, you know, interact on any level with societies that are idolaters, that are you know, worshipping Avodah Zarah. So Yehoshua, I think, according to this theory, composes Aleinu to remind the Jews as they go into Eretz Yisrael, you're special. You know, you're different than everybody else. You bow down to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they worship idols. You need to remind yourself of your uniqueness. If that's true, I think there's a tremendous muster in there, as follows. If there was any generation that you would think didn't need to be reminded of the special quality of being the Jewish people, and the fact that, you know, being Jewish puts you on a higher level than, you know, being a non-Jewish idolater, I would think the generation of Yehoshua certainly qualified for that. What was the nature of the interaction of Yehoshua's generation with the non-Jewish societies in Eretz Yisrael? They were destroying them, right? Through miracles through which, you know, no Jewish people were killed in battle. You really need Aleinu to remind you that the Jews are special? What do you mean? I need Aleinu? No, I go out there into battle against these non-Jewish nations, and they all fall down, you know? They're all conquered by the Jews who are coming through in miraculous fashion, because she was stopping the sun in order to be able to fight against the non-Jews who were in Eretz Yisrael at that time. I really need a tefillah to remind me that the Jews are special? And apparently the answer to that is yes. Yeshua still felt that there was a need to compose a special tefillah accentuating how special it is to be Jewish, how fortunate we are to be Jewish, even with all of the miraculous victories that the Jews enjoyed coming into Eretz Yisrael, a reminder never hurts. Now, if that's true for the generation of Yehoshua, how much more so for any other generation where, you know, clearly there's a great draw that the non-Jewish world exerts on people within the Jewish world. There's oftentimes, one might say even always, a certain sense that, you know what, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. If we were only there, we would achieve prominence, money, you know, success, you know, whatever it happens to be. And the seal of Aleinu is a daily reminder that, you know, that no, it's not true. You know, whatever you see on the surface, whatever prominence, whatever success you may see in the non-Jewish world, still, Shiloh Asano Kigaye Ho'arasos, we are happy. We are incredibly proud that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us special to be the Jewish people with all of the values that we hold of, and, you know, we wouldn't trade that position for anything else in the world. Tremendous, tremendous statement of Jewish pride, but one which apparently is necessary even in a generation when the Jews are clearly on top of the non-Jewish world and decimating the non-Jewish nations around them. There's an interesting practice which, to the best of my knowledge, is only still observed in broyers today with regards to Aleinu. It may be in other places as well, but I think it's only in broyers. But here's the practice, and we observe a variation of this practice on Yom Kippur. In many shuls, they daven Mincha, and then they daven Ma'ariv right after Mincha. Right? So the practice in most shuls today is that you daven Mincha, at the end of Mincha you say Aleinu, and then you go straight into Ma'ariv, and at the end of Ma'ariv you say Aleinu. So you end up saying Aleinu twice in that period of time. The minhag in broyers, whenever Mincha and Ma'ariv are back to back. So in other words, if they daven, you know, in broyers they happen not to daven Mincha and Ma'ariv back to back during the week, and it was just a 15-minute learning session in the middle, but let's say on Fridays, you know, when you dive in Mincha Erev Shabbos, it goes, you know, so if they go straight from Mincha to Kabbalah Shabbos, the minhag in broyers is that they finish davening Mincha, they say the Kaddish to Tiskavel, and they skip Aleinu. They go straight into the Chunaranah. What's that? Oh, right. So the truth is, if you think about it, based on the explanation we gave from the Bach, that actually makes a lot of sense. Aleinu is not about the end of the tefillah. Aleinu is when you're about to leave shul. So if for whatever reason you have two tefillos that are back to back, and you're not leaving shul in the middle, so Aleinu should only be recited at the one at the very end, right? So why doesn't everybody besides Breuers do that? Okay, Breuers are more time conscious. You know, they could save, you know, 37 seconds by not saying an extra Aleinu. By us, okay. So you say an extra Aleinu, get an extra Kaddish out of it, you know, it's all okay. But if you think about it logically, the position that they have really makes sense. And the truth is, we do that, we just don't do that as frequently. Consider the following. Right? You come to Shul Shabbos this morning. How many tefillos do they say in Shul Shabbos this morning? Two. Right? They actually say two tefillos, two for the price of one. Right? You get Shachris and you get Musaf. So, let me ask you the following. Do we say Aleinu at the end of Shachris? No. Right? So why not? I mean, you know, two different tefillos. The answer is because Shachris and Musaf are always daven back to back. Right? Very, very rare that, you know, you daven Shachris and then go somewhere and then come back and daven Musaf. So, to the extent to which Shachris and Musaf are always a pair, so the Aleinu is only at the end of Musaf because that's when you're leaving shul. And the truth is, if you think about our Yom Kippur davening, exactly the same thing. We don't say Aleinu on Yom Kippur till the very end of Ma'ariv, Motzei Yom Kippur. Throughout all of those fields, Shachris, Musaf, Mincha, Ne'ilah, it's just straight, and Aleinu is at the very, very end at Ma'ariv, you know, following Ma'ariv, right before many people are ready to leave shul at that particular point, right? You'll say, but there's an hour and a half break in the middle of the day between Musaf and Mincha. So the truth is, it could be that it makes sense, probably, if you really have an hour and a half break to say Aleinu after Musaf. But what you also see from the way the Machzor is set up is that historically they probably didn't have a break. Right. So some places to this day don't have a break. I mean, certainly when I davened in yeshiva, right, yeshiva, there was enough of a break to take care of whatever physical you needs you had to do during those 20 minutes, and then you went back and davened mincha. That was basically it. But the fact that historically they probably did not have a break is indicated by the fact that there's no Aleinu, you know, at any point during the davening. Historically, you just kept going. You know, maybe you took a 10-minute break or something like that, but everything was straight. You weren't, the expectation was that you wouldn't be leaving shul, you know, in the middle, from the time that you came to shul Yom Kippur morning till you left Motzei Yom Kippur, so there was no Aleinu, you know, at any point during the davening. Alternatively, one might suggest the following. Again, it's a little bit of a different shot. I think this is a little bit more homiletic, but okay. You know, on Yom Kippur, we don't need Aleinu to remind us of how fortunate we are to be Jewish. Right? On Yom Kippur, when we're on the Madrega, where we're on the level of the Malachim, you know, of the angels, so that realization alone is enough to remind us that Shalom Asbanu Kigoye Ho'arasos, so there isn't this need for, you know, having a formal recitation of Aleinu at the end of the davening. Let's talk about Vanachdu Karim Umishtachavim Umodim. Right? So, the word Mishtachavim is usually translated as thou, but truth be told, what Mishtachavim really means is prostrate. In other words, not just the thou, like, you know, chuckling a little bit more than you would normally, but literally to prostrate oneself on the floor. Right? We see that Hishtachavaya, Mishtachavim, has that meaning because Hishtachavaya was something which was carried out in the Beit HaMikdash. In the Beit HaMikdash, whenever an avoda, a service of the Beit HaMikdash, was finished, the Kohen was supposed to be Mishtachavah, at the end, as a sign of thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the end of that particular avoda, that particular activity. In that context, halachically, Hishtachavaya meant getting down on the floor. what we do, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Vanatu Karim Umishtachavim Umodim, is really what the term itself means. Right? Now, when we get down on the floor, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we are literally fulfilling what it says in Olenu, Vanatu Karim Umishtachavim Umodim. We get down on our hands and knees and prostrate ourselves on the floor. This line seems to indicate that Olenu was composed during a period of time when they were still doing Hishtachavaya in the Beis HaMikdash. And this line does seem to point towards a very early composition of Olenu, you know, and lends support to that which Rav Haigon says, that Yoshua ben Nun might have been the author of Olenu. I mean, they didn't have a Beis HaMikdash, but they had a Mishkan. Right? Hishtachavaya is something that is associated uniquely with the Beis HaMikdash. We today certainly acknowledge that God is our God, but we do not do Hishtachavaya on a regular basis. We do not prostrate ourselves on a regular basis in order to indicate that. In fact, just underscoring that point, there's a tshuva for one of the Gaonim where he was asked, how can we still say Olenu today? We don't have a Beis HaMikdash anymore. Right? So that's the very question. I mean, the answer obviously is, yeah, okay. You know, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash when we say Vanachu Karim Mishtachavim. Okay, we don't really mean it in quite the literal sense. We do like a little thing to kind of be reminiscent of how we used to do Hishtachavaya. We bend our heads. But the very question points to the fact that the composition of Olenu seems to be assuming the existence of a Beis HaMikdash and our ability to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that context. Right? So that language seems to point to an early composition of Olenu, and you know, would fit in with the tradition that is attributed to Yeshua ben Nun. Okay. We're going to end here for today. Next week, a little bit early, but next week we're going to continue. There's more in Olenu, we didn't finish it yet, so we're going to continue next week with the second part of the first paragraph of Olenu, and then we'll see Alkei Nekava, the second paragraph of Olenu, where also there's a lot to discuss. And until then, wish everybody a wonderful day.